This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
So I'm going to start off by talking about two movies that I saw this past month that you may have seen and may not, and how they might be implicated in our meditation practice. And the first movie was Kumari. Has anybody seen that movie? Kumari, K-U-M-A-R-E. It's available on Netflix and Amazon Prime. And it is a documentary that won an award at the Sundance Film Festival. And it's about this Indian fellow who was born in New Jersey. And he had issues with yogis, and spiritual teachers as only wanting to gain fame and fortune. And he felt they probably weren't any good. And so what he was going to do is he was going to become one of those spiritual teachers. And he talked like his grandmother. And he had a loincloth and an orange robe and a staff with Om on top of it. And he went to Phoenix, Arizona, and to find his flock. And he made stuff up. He made up yoga postures, and he made up meditation techniques, and he made up Sanskrit words. And a lot of people bought into it and started to follow him and felt that he was their true teacher. They had finally found him. All the while, he intended in this documentary to come out at the end of the documentary and fess up that he wasn't who they thought he was. But as he saw the remarkable transformations, because these people believed he was, he became a bit hesitant and didn't want to burst their bubble and didn't want them to hate him for the rest of his life. So at the end of the movie, his 15 closest disciples gather at a hotel and have lunch. And then they gather in this room, and he comes out in his civilian clothes with his beard cut off and his hair at a reasonable length and not talking with his grandmother's Indian accent. And a couple of people just got up and left, never to talk to him again. They were so disappointed that they had been taken in by this fellow. And others embraced him and thanked him for showing them that they had always had that potential inside of them. And he did, at some point in their relationship, become a teacher, teaching them that they always had the power and didn't need to follow anybody. It's a remarkable movie, and it's heartwarming as well to see how people's lives can be changed when they believe first in other power helping them, but then having that other power transform into self-power. That the potential we all have for nirvana is called our Buddha nature. And it's always there. We were born with it because we're humans. And we have that potential to become perfect as a human being. But we have to realize it. And so this whole practice that we're doing is focused on realizing what's already there. So we don't need to go to India. We can go to Melrose, and it's fine. The second movie, some of you may have seen and heard of, and others probably not. It's called Charlie, based on a book called Flowers for Algernon. It came out in 1968, so some of you probably weren't here. You know, but I can remember being in high school and going on a bus to see this movie because it had been a science fiction movie, and I had always been a fan of science fiction, and it was a short story and then made into a novel and then made into a movie. And the story goes like this. This is this fellow, and he was considered to be mentally challenged. He was retarded. He was 32 and acted like he was 12. And they had come up with a new operation. And this operation would allow him to become a genius. Wow. So they went through a whole lot of people and they chose Charlie. And Algernon was a little mouse. And Algernon had had the operation first. So Charlie and the mouse were pitted against each other. Who could go through the maze fastest? And so the mouse had an actual maze and Charlie had a piece of paper with a maze on it. And Algernon always won. And Charlie was so disappointed. But he gave Algernon credit and called him a really smart mouse. So now Charlie goes in for his operation, and weeks go by, and months go by, and he starts to wake up, and he's reading, and he's understanding, and he's reflecting, and he's becoming really smart. He's starting to see the world in a way that he had never seen it before. But he's also starting to see his friends in a way that he had never seen them before either. And they had made fun of him. And Charlie was in on the joke. He would always laugh with them because he didn't know they were making fun of him. But now he's waking up and he realizes that these people didn't treat him as equal and that they were making fun of him and they were trying to hurt him and he didn't see it and now he did. And so he lost a lot of his friends and a lot of his companions because of the way they treated him. And he started to see the world as a pretty difficult place to live. He didn't see much happiness in the world. He saw a lot of suffering in the world. And at one point in the movie, he's talking to a bunch of experts who were really fascinated by this operation. And they were doctors and people with great knowledge who were going to question him and investigate him. And he gave them answers that they didn't expect. And the answers really led to nothing good. He couldn't find anything that was positive about life or living on Earth, and he saw our future as probably blowing up with an atom bomb. But this is 1968, and we all felt that way. You know? And then, for some reason, the operation started to not work anymore, and he started to go back to how he used to be. And he had found a woman who became his friend, and he fell in love with her. And she fell in love with him. And as he was starting to go back to his original state, she said, "I want to marry you right now, and I want to be with you for the rest of your life." And he said, "No." And then she said, "Okay, I'll just stay with you until you tell me it's time to leave." And he said, "It's time to leave." So at the end of the movie, he's back in the playground. He's back to his old self, and he's smiling, and he's laughing, and he's having a really good time. And when you saw the movie or read the book, you sort of felt sorry for him because he had all this insight and knowledge, but he was terribly unhappy. And now, when he doesn't know, he seems to be sort of okay with the world. So here we are trying to wake up and see the world the way it really is. And you have to sort of wonder if it's going to make our lives any better at all when we see how cruel this place is and how insensitive people are to their fellow humans and to their fellow animals as well. There's a fellow I was just reading about who went to war in Iraq, and he's now decided to die. I was listening to NPR last night. And he was shot after 5 days in Iraq, and his spinal cord was severed, and he couldn't walk. And he wrote a scathing letter about Bush and Cheney. And he just really has come to a place of peace with the fact that he's not going to take any more water or food and just sort of die naturally, that this is going to be the end of his life. And you sort of have to wonder, with all the concepts that we have in our head about right and wrong and good and bad and skillful and unskillful, are we being motivated in a way that's going to lead to our demise as well? Are we being motivated and manipulated by everything and everyone in the world to be this way or that way, to sort of fit in, produce and consume? Huh? And you have to sort of think about it for a while, and then you might say, maybe. Do I have any original thoughts in my head? And I haven't had one yet. I'm waiting, though. That most of the stuff I think about and the way I think about stuff was put there by family and friends and peer groups and schools and political systems, and whoa. And here I am choosing this over that, and is there really any choice at all to make? And what would be the right choice? Would it be the good choice or the bad choice? Well, in Buddhism, our choice is really plain. It's really clear. And that's what I like about Buddhism. There's no discussion on what to choose. And the choice for Buddhists would be, do I choose less suffering? Do I choose more suffering? Man, it's as simple as that. You know, for myself and others. In what I'm thinking, saying, and doing today, is that changing the world and making less suffering or more suffering? Not necessarily a better world. I don't know if we're ever going to have a better world, but I don't really know what better is, you know? But I do know we need duality and to decide better and worse. Now, I've been invited, I was invited to go to this peace concert, which I'll be part of, on April 8th in North Hollywood. And we have a lot of people there who actually sing and write songs and have published CDs and like are really good. And so they asked me to come and do a loving kindness meditation. And I said, okay, but only if I can play my ukulele. Because I want to play one song too, seeing as this is going to be a peace concert. And they said, but what could your song possibly offer that these professionals can't do? And I said, well, my song will let everybody know that they're really good, because I'm not. So you have to have a not so good to have a good. I'll be serving a function there. And in the same way, Kumari served the function of being a fake teacher so real teachers could exist in the world. You can't have one without the other in a dualistic mindset. And you can't have good without bad. Now, yesterday, speaking of that, I was at Leisure World in Seal Beach. We have a small Buddhist group that meets there. And they're all about my age or older, so it's a lot of fun. And we had a new fellow yesterday who came in. And the new fellow says, I used to be Christian. And I said, okay, getting ready for something. And he says, you know, do you guys have an afterlife? I said, yeah, we've got like heavens and hells and all sorts of places to go. And then he says, do you guys have to get judged before you get in? Will there be somebody there at the door determining if you are good or bad? Because he says, the thing about Christianity that I don't like is I've got to be judged. And most of the stuff in my life, I didn't have too much to do with. That it was consequences and other conditions arising. And that's what caused it. It wasn't my fault. And I get a feeling if I'm going to go to heaven and I get judged, I won't get in. Do you guys judge? I said, no, we have no form of justice at all. In Buddhism, we lack a divine lawgiver to define for us what is right or wrong. We have karma, cause and consequence. So you get to go to heaven as a Buddhist if you have skillful thoughts, skillful speech, and skillful action. It's all up to you. You don't have to believe in anything. You don't have to have devotion in anything. You just need to be skillful. He said, I really like that. I'm coming back next night. So we may have a convert. I'm not sure, you know. But it's so funny as we look at this dualistic mindset that we're sort of stuck with because we have the gift of awareness, self-awareness. So, I'm thinking, how do we protect ourselves from really hating everyone and everything in the world as we wake up, as we get a little more clarity, as we start to see clearly how screwed up this place is. Okay. Well, the first thing we need to do, and I've said this before, is we need to practice the precepts, the five precepts. Why the five precepts? This is our first chance to be free. The five precepts is our first chance to be free. And you may not think that's the case. You may say, well, but, you know, the first precept is I'll practice not to kill. How can I be free by not killing? You know? And in Buddhism, when they talk about being free, they're only talking about one thing, being free from suffering. Not being free to do anything you want. That's not freedom, that's anarchy. We had some of that in the 60s too. You know? So they all got stoned and everything's okay. I was watching an excellent video on Crosby, Stills, and Nash this morning before I came in. And they had this one scene at 4:19 in this little film that was filmed at Esalen, this one guy rolling a joint. And everybody's got the great clothes on and the big hair, and they're bouncing all around. I'm thinking, well, that would be so cool to have been there, you know? And where did they all go? They're all in Leisure World now. I get to visit them, you know? So anyway, the precepts allow us to start being free immediately. Free from suffering, and free from creating more suffering in the world. Okay, so freeing ourselves from having the obligation to kill, or even the need to kill, or even wanting to kill. And I tell you what, you look at the news, and everybody's killing everybody, all the time. And you just sort of wonder, what the hell is wrong? What part of being a human requires us to go out and start killing people? And I suppose it stems from survival. That at some point when we were tribal or hunters and gatherers, you know, we had to protect the clan. And so you had the hunters to protect it, and they had like rocks and sticks, and they'd either whack you or kill you and to protect everybody. But here we are now with like LA, 4 million people, you know, trying to live together. I don't know if we need to whack each other quite as much, you know? How do we get along with each other? How do we not kill each other? What do we need to do? All we need to do is practice the first precept, according to Buddhism. Not to take what's not given, not to indulge in sexual misconduct, not to speak unskillfully, not to consume intoxicants. Five ways of beginning to end our suffering and the suffering of others. Cool. Also defines our boundaries for us. So as we start to transcend who we are, in our meditation practice, we have that as our safeguard, that we won't go over those boundaries because we're practicing them. It's a very important part of our practice. So when we come to that place of being interconnected and interdependent, and we're all one, and isn't it just wonderful, you're not going to kill anybody or rape anybody or steal all that stuff because you've got those precepts. On Facebook, just one woman wrote, it just blew my mind. She says, I am getting so tired of telling my daughter not to get raped. You know? And it's coming up all the time. There's that one girl, 16, who was just those two guys and da-da-da-da. I don't know, men, you know? Mm-hmm. And how can we have a lifestyle that doesn't encourage that? That wakes us up to the fact that there are boundaries in order for us to live together that we have to honor, you know? If we all lived alone, we could do pretty much anything we wanted, but, you know, there's no place I have found where we're all alone. We seem to need relationships. We seem to need other people. So, we got the boundaries laid out. Now we start on our samatha meditation, our tranquility meditation. And if you read, you know, basic Buddhism 101, what you find is that Buddha did that first, and then he did insight meditation. And insight meditation allowed him to gain clarity and insight into the true nature of himself and in the way he experienced the world. And he didn't go nuts. He seemed to still be a pretty nice guy. And I think it's because of the samatha meditation. because the Samatha meditation allows us to have bliss and happiness and tranquility in our meditation. It sort of like surrounds us with a cocoon. So all this clarity and insight we're going to be gaining in our mindfulness meditation hits this cocoon of samadhi, this bliss and this happiness, sort of slows it down, makes it a little more soft and angular rather than hard and corners. And then we go, oh yeah, okay, I see it, I got it. But it doesn't, I'm not going crazy, I don't have a lot of hatred and anger for it, I'm just observing it. Because now it's being filtered through my samadhi, through my bliss, through my happiness. So when I first started doing mindfulness meditation, man, I got agitated. I just didn't like people after a while. You know, I didn't like the way they drove. I didn't like the way they ate. I didn't like the way they talked. And that was just me, about me. And then I'm looking at everybody else. I'm going, yeah, they do the same thing I do. And I realized I'd have to change my approach to my meditation, or else I wasn't going to be a better person. I was going to be a really bad person, an angry person, an unhappy person. So that's when I came upon this whole thing about samatha and concentration, deep states of one-pointedness. Not momentary concentration like you find in mindfulness, but deep states of concentration that last for a half hour, an hour, hour and a half. And you're just piercing the veils of your object of meditation. So if your object of meditation is the breath, the sensation of breath, it's like a laser-like focus that you have on the breath. And nothing else exists. Just the breath. And all of a sudden, what you find first, at least I did, was my past and my future started to fall away. And I didn't have one that I could refer to. I was sort of more and more into the present moment experience of my meditation practice. And as I became aware of that, I also noticed that my body map was dissolving. Each one of us in our heads has this map of where our body ends and the world begins. And that's why we can pick things up and drive and not have to look at our hands all the time. And as I got more and more one-pointed in my meditation practice, that started to dissolve. And I couldn't figure out where I ended and the world began. Which was fine. I was sitting in a meditation center and it was very secure. I didn't have to be too concerned about where I ended and it began. But I started to see that this whole world of mine really depended on a false sense of duality. That as my duality of past and future fell away, or me and it, me and them fell away, I sort of came to this place of connection with the world around me. That now, it was almost like before I had my intellect, when I was just born and I was just, and the universe and me were the exact same thing. The cosmos and me were the exact same thing. And it was fine until I was hungry. And then I would cry, and then the universe would feed me. Later I figured out it was mom. But at that point, it was just, I was being taken care of by the universe. So here we're going back to the universe. And we're reconnecting in a very special way. Not forgetting everything we know, but transcending everything we know for just a few moments in our meditation practice. And some of the characteristics that occur with deep states of concentration are physical bliss and pleasure. There's an actual sensation of bliss and pleasure that runs through your entire body, your entire nervous system, tingling and feeling so good. Absolutely free. Cool. Then there's a deep state of happiness in the mind that arises because of a deep focus, this laser focus we have. So here we sit in great pleasure and happiness. And oh, it is just such a pleasant place to visit after you've gone to work and you've driven home and you're hungry and you're tired, and then for 20 minutes, man, you just visit this place of bliss, pleasure, and happiness. And it just like recharges all your batteries that have been depleted because of greed, hatred, anger, and delusion. Okay. Now, this is when I think we're ready for mindfulness, because we found the happiness that's always inside of us. It doesn't have to exist outside in order for it to exist inside, but don't tell Disneyland that. And we find the pleasure, this actual sensation of pleasure and bliss that always exists inside. We always have that potential. We just needed to find the button. And now we start with our mindfulness practice, and we start seeing things in a rather unique way. And the first thing we start to notice is, like, all things are always changing. Nothing stays the same very long at all. And this can be really disconcerting, because what we come to understand is there is no place for us to stand and take a position. That every time we take a position of right and wrong, all those characteristics change in the very next moment, and it brings our choice into question. Am I really making the right choice now that I have more information in the next moment, in the next moment? And we come to the conclusion that we can never make a 100% right choice, because all the conditions are always in a state of flux. We can guesstimate, we can be close, we can be confident, but to be 100% right, probably not. So that's going to change the way you respond to the world around you. What that's going to do for you is make you humble. It's going to give you a sense of humility. And when somebody says he or she knows, you'll go, maybe so, maybe so. But that's about all you're going to do. And in that, you're reconnecting with the river, if you will. You know how Buddhism always talking about the river, we got the raft, we go across to the other side, you can't put your foot in the same river twice because it's always moving. Now, all that river stuff, we have just jumped into that river. And we're sort of gone into the flow of all of this without trying to swim upstream or against the stream. What we're going to do is just sort of jump in and see what it's like. You know, how does it feel to let your intuition and your intellect work together to help define who you are? There's something called synchronicity, that sometimes when we're in the flow, stuff happens like it's supposed to. Unexplained and hard to prepare for. But you're in downtown LA, you have an appointment, and there's a parking meter that's open, and there's money in it already. Man, how did that happen? Did the universe know you needed that parking place? Are you in sync now with the cosmos? Cool. But then as soon as you take credit for it, as soon as self takes credit for it, it's over. Man, forget it. You'll never find another parking place. So impermanence can be our friend. We don't have to just say, I hate impermanence, because everything I really want, cherish, and hold on to is going to be taken away from me. But the whole idea is, yeah, you're not supposed to hold on to it. You're supposed to really enjoy it, experience it, and then get ready for the next thing. And that works with relationships and cars and food. It works with everything. That to go through life with an open hand, because you understand impermanence, that things will be put in that open hand and things will be taken out of that open hand. And it only causes suffering when you close your hand. So keep that hand open. Impermanence, cool. Okay, and now you've got all this bliss and pleasure that's sort of allowing you to reflect and go into deep states of rumination on the implications of impermanence. So now we come to the second place, suffering. This is like the biggest thing. And this is the greatest insight you're ever going to have, that life sucks. You know, and it is a tough sell, I want to tell you. Monday, tomorrow, I'm going to Immaculate Heart Catholic High School and giving a presentation on Buddhism. And the first thing I'm going to do is tell these girls how difficult life is, and that all that's ahead for you in your life is suffering and dissatisfaction. And I've got to point out all the different ways they're going to suffer, which takes the first half of my presentation. But now the second half of my presentation is to tell them how to end their suffering. But in order for them to end their suffering, they have to know they are suffering. That's the deal. So we sort of wake up to the fact that this life isn't what we think it is. That this life will lead to dissatisfaction, dis-ease, discomfort, suffering. No matter what you do, how much money you have, how smart you are, you'll never be ultimately and totally satisfied with it for very long. There are moments when things seem to be just the way they're supposed to be. But now we factor in impermanence, that first deep insight we had, and realize that this is such a special moment because it seems really good. I'm surprised how good it feels. If you've studied Buddhism long enough, you're never surprised in how bad it feels. That you're ready for. But the good stuff just goes, whoa, hey, this isn't in the book. It's not supposed to feel like this. But it's soon taken away from us because of impermanence. So what we do is we stop holding on. Again, holding on, attachment and aversion. The other side of attachment is aversion. Those two things, attachment and aversion, always lead to more suffering because of impermanence. Because of impermanence. Okay, so it's starting to sink in now, but we still have our bliss and our happiness and our pleasure still running through because we haven't given up samatha meditation completely. We still go back to samatha meditation. But we're now doing mindfulness as well to be really clear about things. And now we come to this last part, the hardest part of all in mindfulness meditation, the hardest insight to grasp, I think, and that's the not-self insight. That I am not who I think I am, and I never have been. I am also not who anybody else thinks I am either. And that can be really uncomfortable. I was talking to some friends last night. We were meditating, and I was teaching them some stuff about meditation. And it came up, one of them never felt that she belonged any place. She's born in Europe, came over here from Europe, lives in California now. Every time she goes back to Europe, she doesn't feel like she belongs. When she's in California, she really doesn't feel like she belongs. She just can't find her place. You know? And I mentioned, you know, I've always felt the same way, you know, because when I was young, I wanted to be cool, but I never fit into the cool place, you know. And then I wanted to be smart, but I was never smart enough. And then I wanted to have a nice car, but I could never afford a nice car, so my car was nice enough. And then I remember this one meditation center I went to, and it was Zen, and like everybody was sitting around, and they all had their hands like this, you know, and... But I had my hands on my knees like this because that's how I meditated. And the head guy in this meditation center comes over to me and whispers in my ear, "You can't sit like that. If you continue to sit like that, you'll have to leave because we all sit the same way here." And I'm going, "I don't even fit in here. How am I going to get enlightened? I don't fit in." You know, so we went into this, but you know what? None of us fit in. It's a big conspiracy when we think we fit in. It's just other people thinking we fit in too, but their minds will change. You know? So we don't have to fit in. But what we do have to do is try to figure out who we are, because that will give us a reference point in our relationships with the world and the people in it. And so the Buddha came up with this idea that, you know what? There is not a fixed, independent, always the same kind of self that exists inside of us. That we're in a constant state of flux and change, impermanence. Okay? And if you think you are that person, or if you think you are that soul or essence, you might be having an illusion about that. It may not be true. And then you go back to your samatha meditation and get the bliss and happiness again. Because now you're going to investigate, am I really who I think I am? And the Buddha said, we're mind and body. Okay, that sort of works. We're the five aggregates, form, sensation, perception, volition, and consciousness. We're the 32 parts of the body. Okay. He had a lot of ways of describing human beings, but he never said we're simply one thing. He said we're always two things or more connected. Always two things or more. It would feel so good to be one thing. How easy it would be to define ourselves in. I'm Kusala. Okay, I'm one thing. You know? But then you look for the one thing and it's not there. And then you start to see that, gosh, you know, maybe not only don't I fit in, but maybe I'm not anything at all. Maybe I'm just activity. Maybe I'm just thinking. You know? Okay, cool. So what would be the benefit of that? How would that be useful? What would the Buddha tell us about that? He would say, perhaps, I don't want to speak for him, but he would say perhaps that if you're not anything in particular, there's nothing to defend. If someone doesn't like you or curses you, you know, who's cursing you and who are they cursing? Just the process, just an unfolding of the cosmos in your intimate life, and you go, whoa, how cool is that? He really hates me. Wow. You know? What part of the five aggregates doesn't he like? The form or the sensation, the perception, the volition, the consciousness? What part does he hate? Okay. And then when I'm grasping and clinging and attaching or have strong aversion and repulsion, who is it that's attaching? And who is it that has the aversion? Who stands there and defines himself by that attachment and aversion? The illusion of self, ego, independence, essence. Wow, okay. So when we come to grips with we may not be who we think we are, we still have that pleasure and that feeling of happiness. We still got that. You know, that's sort of our medication, if you will. And we come to this place of not standing apart ever again. We are now forever interconnected and interdependent. We now, in the most true sense, don't exist independently. We exist with everything all the time. And that gives us a deep insight into why those five precepts were so useful as boundaries. Because we couldn't see we were connected to the thing we were about to kill. We thought it wouldn't affect us in any real way. And all of a sudden we find that that thing we're about to kill actually turns out to be part of us. And that the suffering the thing's going to feel, we're going to feel it too. Maybe not in a conscious way, but in an intuitive, heartfelt way. Wow. Okay, will that change the way we respond to the world? I think it will. It'll give us deep insight, but we're also going to have the bliss and the happiness and the pleasure to sort of temper that deep insight so we won't go nuts. And we'll be able to be very skillful doing the dance between relative and ultimate. That'll be our dance now. And now we've come to understand we may not be who we are, but the police pull us over for speeding, and we hand them our driver's license, and we say to the police officer, you know, I'm not really this guy anymore. He doesn't exist in the way I always thought he did. And the police officer will say, well, I don't care who this guy is, but he's getting a ticket. So we have to still be us. We really do. Because our friends and our relatives will be very uncomfortable if we start not being who they think we are. So we need to be those people. But it's our secret as a meditator that I have options I never had before because I am becoming free of having to be who they think I am. So I can be free to choose. I can be free to reduce suffering in the world rather than increase suffering. And off you go with your meditation practice. Some may call it enlightenment. Maybe. But it could be just our birthright as humans that we fully realize that this meditation practice, this Dharma that we're trying to understand, is speeding up our evolution as a human. That our culture only takes us so far. It doesn't want us to go too far, because then we don't produce and consume quite as much as we could if we had stopped there. But some of us, perhaps, say, hey, I want to see what's beyond that. I want to see what it means to go beyond being an American. It goes beyond being a Republican or Democrat. Maybe beyond being a male or a female. What does it mean to go beyond and taste that freedom? And I've got the precepts so I don't lose my way. I've got my bliss and happiness so I feel comfortable and energized along the way. And now I've got my clarity. And it comes down to how can I be of service? How can I be of service? What do I need to do to make things better? Maybe we could stop burning coal. Just maybe. You know, that might make things better. How can that be of service? And we all have our own expertise and talents, and we could all go into the world, as those early Buddhist monks did, to reduce suffering. But because we're in America, because we have a different culture, we probably could go out and be more engaged in ending suffering. And maybe just not one at a time, but maybe groups at a time of people who are hungry. And apparently there's enough food to feed everybody in the world. It just isn't distributed correctly. You know? So there's like a lot of work for us to do. And all the while, it wouldn't drive us crazy. We wouldn't think we're never going to succeed, because that's not the point. The point isn't to succeed. I know it sounds harsh and cold. The point is to actively participate. That's all. And whatever you're doing will have benefit. Is there a goal? You don't want to have a goal, because goals happen in the future. None of this work is going to happen in the future. All this work is going to happen right now. So it's fine to have a little goal and think it's cool to have a goal. But, you know, by the time the future is here today, there's no goal. There's just less people hungry. You know, that's all. Cool, okay. So I keep working today and I keep working today. And then today becomes different. No future, no past. So when I watched the movie Charlie, I saw that he went from don't know to know too much, back to don't know. And what we would say, perhaps in Buddhism and especially in Zen, is what do you know? Don't know. That means everything is a possibility. As soon as you know, you've limited yourself. Man, bummer. Okay, I'm going to stop there. This might be enough for one day.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.